Today's episode is easily one of my favorites. If I could make it required listening for everybody that I know, I totally would. I just want to give you a little forewarning that we do talk about sex and all of the body parts associated with it. So if you have little ears around and you are uncomfortable with that type of language, I would pop in some headphones or listen when you have some time alone, but definitely listen to this episode and take notes. You will thank me later. So without further ado, this was my conversation with Dr. Kelly Casperson. Hello and welcome to On the Brighter Side. I'm your host, Monica Tanner, and I'm so excited about my guest today. Before I read her introduction, let me just tell you that I fully believe that when you are living right, the universe provides all these little happy accidents. And I am so excited that I met this woman, and we haven't known each other for very long, but I just feel like we were destined to be friends because she is an actual doctor who loves to talk about my favorite subject, which is women's sexual health. So Dr. Casperson is a urologist. She has advanced training in pelvic medicine and surgery. No tools learned in medical school prepared her for the wave of women that were hungry for her help and education about their pelvis and sexual health. So she pursued even more education: sexual health, intimacy, the science of desire, and female sexual response. She is completely self-taught. Now it is her job to teach others, women, doctors, nurses, practitioners, and physician assistants, because she can't teach women one-on-one in her clinic and expect to touch a drop in the ocean of this need. Her mission is to teach women that you are not broken. Please help me welcome to the podcast today, Dr. Kelly Casperson. How are you doing?
I'm so great. Thanks for having me.
I feel like we're soul sisters.
I know. I know. I'm super excited. I'm like, oh, I get to talk to you today. Awesome. Especially in the time of COVID, right? Like when people aren't really hanging out in real life, you're like, oh, I get to like sit down and have like an awesome chat with somebody.
Yes. And talk about my favorite subject in the whole wide world. Let's do this. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your family?
Sure. So I went to medical school. I was born and raised in Minnesota in a very traditional Catholic family, which I think does play into how the heck I got to my day job, right? And then I was kind of torn between OB-GYN and urology as far as what to do, but I loved, like, delivering babies is a miracle and amazing, but I really like sleeping. And I think babies come at like 2 a.m. and so I thought, well, maybe that's not for me. And I loved urology and I had no trouble talking about all the urology words, you know, mostly penis, because urology is way more male dominated than women dominated. It's actually pretty rare still to have a female urologist in an average town. So I did my urology training, and then my husband and I moved to Washington State, and now I have 2 little girls, and they know where their vulva is because of their mom. And here I am kind of living my best life. And I got to the point where I see people one-on-one in clinic, and I just got to the point after seeing it over and over that there's so little education or even accurate education that I'm like, I need to reach out. I need to start educating. And my platform of being a doctor and being that urologist kind of gives me all the more power to say, hey, I actually might know something about this topic. And so to start a podcast and then to meet people like you to be like, oh my gosh, there's this whole grassroots of women trying to get out accurate medical knowledge about people's bodies, which is so lacking in our culture.
Yeah. Well, I love it so much. We talk a lot about intimacy and we talk about like the brain stuff behind intimacy, but it's so fun to have like a medically trained doctor who actually knows so much about, you know, all of the anatomy that's involved in intimacy. So let's get started. Let's start with the basics. So your medical specialty is all of the organs in the pelvic region of the body. But for women specifically, that covers, I was trying to like figure out how to describe this. Like if you were wearing a G-string underwear, basically you are an expert at everything that is covered there.
Yeah. You know, it's really tough. It's like, it's really hard to know about a part of your body that's so hidden, right?
Yes.
Like, so it's challenging. Unless you actually take a mirror and look, you might not ever see these organs, but there are distinct organs organs. They're all involved in the health of each other and certainly involved in pleasure. And to get to know people's own anatomy and to know it's okay to talk about it is just absolutely huge.
Yeah. And talking about it is one of the biggest things I think that adds to our sexual health and experience. So let's do a quick anatomy lesson for those of us who are excited to talk about this. Can you talk about the function of all the major female sex organs, like the vagina, the vulva, the clitoris, and others?
Yeah. So the vagina, let's start with the vagina, because the word vagina kind of just gets thrown into like what you have down there is a vagina. And that's actually wrong, right? What you have are genital urinary organs, one of which is a vagina. And the vagina is actually a hollow tube. And that's what babies come out of, sex toys and penises go into. So it's really the internal tubular structure that connects the outside vulva to the kind of upstairs cervix and uterus. So the vulva is all the external, all the hardware that's outside of the vagina. So that includes the labia majora, which is kind of the hair-bearing, larger spongy tissue. And then inside the labia majora is the labia minora. And those are hairless structures. Their job is to protect the vagina, and their job is to protect the urethra. And we can get into that more about what happens to those structures in menopause, because they're very hormone dependent. So that's the two labias that are very important in protecting the vagina. Then a little more forward would be your urethra, where you pass urine from. And then above your urethra is the clitoris. And the clitoris is really, if you look at homologs or similarities, the clitoris is the female penis. If we want to bring the penis into female anatomy, it's actually about the size of a penis. All we see, though, is this little pencil tip eraser, kind of outermost part of it, which is called the head of the clitoris. And it's actually covered with skin, which is called in the male would be the foreskin, but it would be the glandular covering of the clitoris. So most of the clitoris wraps inside, around, and kind of inside the labia majora, which is why a lot of women might find that labial touch or spreading of the vulva is sexually pleasurable to them, because there's actually a clitoral body inside that, my gosh, people don't know where the outside part of the clitoris is. And the fact that there's actually way more to it and it's on the inside is mind-blowing to a lot of people.
So this is so fascinating, because I throw this around a lot, but I've never like talked to a medical professional about it. But women are actually anatomically built to experience pleasure from intercourse. Is that right?
Totally. I mean, what's so cool about the clitoris is it's the only organ designed specifically for the sensation of pleasure. It has no other purpose but pleasure. And then you're like, but wait, what about the penis? And you're like, no. The penis has a job to get the pee through it, and it also has the job to put sperm or semen into the female for reproduction. The penis actually has multiple jobs, if you consider that, where the clitoris is literally the only organ just for pleasure.
Well, that's actually great news.
Isn't that amazing? It's so great. You're like, oh yeah, look what we got that other people don't have.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I feel like we bear the responsibility to grow a child inside of us and then push the child outside of us. That's a lot of responsibility that we have. And so to know that we also have this part of our anatomy that is just meant to give us pleasure, like, that kind of makes me relieved.
Yeah, I mean, what a gift, right? Evolutionarily, like, pleasure is important, right? That's why we have a hunger to eat. It's pleasurable to eat because our body actually needs it. And so it's like we've created something to give us pleasure because it's part of having a healthy body.
Yeah. Oh, I love that way of looking at it. Okay. So teach us about female desire and why there is often such a mismatch when it comes to desire and the female sexual response.
Yeah. Desire is so fun to talk about. So traditionally, when scientists and researchers started developing concepts of normal sexual response, they put desire first. So it was desire, arousal, and then orgasm. It was kind of this very linear thing. So people in their mind say, well, desire has to come first. And if you don't have desire, then the other things don't happen. And then going along, a female researcher was actually like, I don't think that's how it happens in most females. I think arousal comes first, followed by desire, followed by orgasm, which kind of really turns the tide on on thinking about, is desire necessary to have a satisfying sexual life? And what we've learned is responsive desire, which is not arising spontaneously from us, but coming because of arousal or because of an interest in engaging in intercourse, that's the more normal one, is being responsive. So I think realizing that that's completely normal, and it's more normal the older women get, right? That kind of spontaneous desire that you think of in Hollywood, where people just can't keep their hands off, you're like doing your Excel spreadsheet and you just think about sex all the time. Like, that's actually not industry standard. Industry standard is you've had a really busy day, you've got a to-do list, you're not thinking about sex at all, but then your partner comes up and maybe starts wanting to get you in the mood, and now you're playing and in the mood, and you say, nah, this is great, this is fun, I'm having a fun time, but you didn't spontaneously seek that out. Yes. And that's so normalizing to so many women to realize responsive desire is actually the majority.
For sure. And there is that huge difference between spontaneous and responsive desire types. And it's important to know that those two play together and work together really, really well, because if we all had spontaneous desire, nothing would ever get done. And if we all had a responsive desire, then the human race would probably cease to exist. So you have to have both, and it's good to appreciate both the different desire types.
Totally. And another analogy for it that I really like, and going back to kind of that hunger and the hunger drive, is spontaneous hunger versus reactive hunger, right? So spontaneous hunger is like, I'm thinking about food, I'm going to go seek out food. So that's spontaneous hunger. Whereas a responsive or reactive hunger is, I had this great meal, but oh my Lord, they just brought out the dessert table.
Yeah.
And that's looking fantastic.
Yeah.
So like, you weren't seeking it out, you weren't looking for more, but oh my gosh, the opportunity arose and now you're going to have a good time with the dessert table. And kind of switching it, looking at a different kind of hunger response is a way to say, oh, okay, this reactive versus spontaneous is actually something that happens in other parts of our living life too.
Yeah. Or even like, you know, I can be not really hungry, but if I'm walking around and I smell this cheeseburger, all of a sudden I'm starving because I smell this cheeseburger. And that's almost like how sex works a little bit too, right?
Yep.
Especially for women or people who have a more responsive desire type. It's not like they're walking around horny, but you know, it definitely, the aroma or the circumstance or something could put them more in the mood for a sexual encounter, kind of like a smell of a cheeseburger.
Absolutely.
But oftentimes I think what happens with women is that they'll desire or they'll want to be in the mood, but anatomically they're not prepared, or the other way around, they'll be prepared, but there's like no situation happening. So can you explain why that might happen?
Yeah, so it's really common. It's actually a documented phenomenon called arousal desire mismatch. And so the pelvis is built to kind of protect itself and to kind of do its own thing on autopilot a little bit. And so sometimes the brain and the pelvis aren't always coordinated. And so a woman can be like, hey, I'm in the mood, I'm kind of wanting to get into this, I need extra help, I'm not lubricated, my pelvis isn't relaxed. And so that's desire arousal mismatch, where you're getting ready for the party, but you might not have the lubrication that you want. And that's incredibly common. And it's another reason that I tell women that lubrication for sex is absolutely a great thing, and it's not bad. And it's not a sign that you're not desiring sex to not have enough moisture, especially as the years go on and menopause and the lack of estrogen really dries out the tissues. You're going to need a little bit more in order to have sex be comfortable. Because going back again to desire, it's very hard to desire anything that's painful. So we want to do everything we can to have something worthy of desire, and having pain-free sex makes it a lot easier to desire things. You don't desire things that aren't fun or comfortable.
Right, exactly. And so one of the ways I knew we were going to be instant really good friends is when we both reached over and had a tube of lube on our desk, both of us.
Like, that is the best.
Lube on my desk. It's just, it gives me inspiration to know where I'm going and what I'm doing.
I love it.
So do you, apparently.
Yeah.
Awesome. So some women complain of painful intercourse. Can you explain a few of the medical conditions that might cause painful intercourse and perhaps some simple or not so simple solutions to some of these conditions?
Absolutely. So one of the common reasons is a woman, and again, I'm talking very traditionally, you know, heterosexual penis and vagina, but just talking in kind of gross generalities, a woman might have pain or discomfort because she's putting the penis in her vagina way too soon. And she might be doing that because she just wants to please the guy, or they might be doing that because they don't know how to turn her on. But what the vagina does to get ready for sex is it actually lengthens and tilts backwards. So it actually prepares itself to accommodate the penis. And so if you don't have that turned on, relaxed pelvic muscles where the vagina is actually saying, okay, I'm ready for something to work now, you're going to have a lot more pain because the vagina is going to be tight and it's going to be shortened. It's going to be very uncomfortable. So proper arousal and stimulation to get the blood flow going to get the vagina prepared for sex is very important. Nobody gets taught that in sex ed. And so I think a lot of women are having unnecessary painful sex simply because they didn't take their own pleasure first in getting the vagina ready to accept another human. So that's a very common one that I see. Another common one, again, going back to no lube, is just too much friction is never good. So lots of lube is great. And then as the ages go on and you get into that perimenopausal, postmenopausal stage, the tissues get very dry, especially at the entrance of the vulva, kind of at that 6 o'clock lower part of the vulva. So right at the entrance, not so much that the vagina is uncomfortable, but just the entry point and that friction is too much. And the tissues there get very tight and thinned because of low estrogen. So that would be something where you'd go to ask your doctor to say, hey, I understand that there's some estrogen cream products just used locally that I think could really help me have pain-free sex.
That is fantastic. Wow. I thought that I knew a lot about sex and I didn't know either one of those things. So I'm really, really glad we're having this conversation.
Awesome. I know it's a lot, right? But it's like once you know it and realize it, you're like, that's that whole thing about like you're not broken, right? If once you understand it, you realize like, oh, what am I? I'm experiencing things that like there's a good reason that I'm experiencing those things. You know, there's like science behind it. It's just awesome. So fun to talk about.
It's so great. Well, there's two things that stand out to me. The first that you mentioned is I think that it is really important for women to understand that it's okay for them to focus on their own arousal. So, you know, sex is definitely going to be more enjoyable for the couple if both parties are enjoying themselves. And so it does take a little bit longer to prepare a woman's body for the actual act of intercourse. And that's okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Totally okay. If you rush in and your body's not prepared, it's not going to be fun for you. You're not going to desire sex. And when I counsel to a lot of women about their low sexual desire, you have to make sure that the sex and intimacy itself is fun and enjoyable because you can never desire something, you know, like the cheeseburgers, right? My big thing is melted ice cream.
I was going to say, I've heard you talk about melted ice cream.
Yep. I can't make you like melted ice cream. I can't do it.
Right. I love it. Well, such a great way to think about it because I love ice cream, but you know, ice cream in and of itself is good, but if it's melted, it's hard to want it, right? And then the second thing I thought about was hormones. So obviously hormones play a huge role in female sexual response. So what are some of the important things you can just tell us quickly about what to know about hormones when, you know, that becomes an issue?
Yeah. So when people think about hormones, there's two different types of hormones. There's systemic hormones, like the hormones that you can take or that are in your brain. And then there's localized hormones, like how I was talking about with the estrogen creams. The vulva, the vagina, the clitoris, all the female organs became female because they saw female hormones. And to a role testosterone, which women actually have tons of testosterone, just about 1/10 of the male dose. But we technically have, I've even read, we have more testosterone than we have estrogen. So we have to stop thinking about testosterone as a very male hormone. We have tons of it. We just have 1/10 the male dose. Testosterone is incredibly important in helping those tissues, especially in tenderness and in pain situations. So estrogen and testosterone used locally on the vulva can be very therapeutic for some conditions. So that's topical hormones. And then systemic hormones, estrogen, progesterone, which basically go away after menopause, and then testosterone, which your ovaries always will make throughout your life, but at a much lower dose after menopause. Testosterone is the hormone really involved in sex drive and kind of desire for sex. And so that can go down, and it can actually go down dramatically in women who have their ovaries removed surgically, because the ovaries always make testosterone. And when the ovaries are removed, you automatically have no more more testosterone. And so I talked to a lot of women after surgery for various conditions where their sex drive just disappears because they've lost that hormone.
Okay, so you've touched on estrogen, testosterone. Those are like the big ones. But I've also heard you talk about something called binding globulin, which is one of the lesser known hormones. But if we're still struggling and we feel like we've gone the estrogen, testosterone route, can you talk about some of those lesser known hormones that we might consider in any type of sexual dysfunction?
Sure. Yeah. So sex hormone binding globulin is actually a protein that the liver makes, and it can be increased for no good reason, or it can be increased with certain medications like birth control pills. And what sex hormone binding globulin does is it binds the sex hormone, so it's very aptly named. And so you can have an okay amount of hormones, your body's producing normal hormones, but let's say you've been on birth control for a very long time, basically you are creating this situation where all your hormones are bound up. And if your hormones are bound up, then they can't go out and act on the organs and the receptors that want to see the hormones. So that's one test that I do, is we check for the sex hormone binding globulin to say, hey, even if your sex hormones are normal, maybe your body's not seeing them because they're being bound by this protein that the liver makes. So that's just kind of a test to kind of say, hey, what's going on for the symptoms you might be seeing me for. Another hormone specifically that people can use topically is now FDA approved. It's called Intrarosa. And what it is it's DHEA, which is a precursor to testosterone and estrogen. They're actually testing this medication for people with recurrent UTIs, which is fascinating. So having low hormones in the vulva and vagina actually throws off your pH and throws off the healthy bacteria that help prevent UTIs. So replenishing your natural hormones, again, talking about topically, can help decrease UTIs as well. So it's another hormone that we use, not just for sexual intercourse, but for the health of the female pelvis.
So that brings up actually a really interesting question that I'd love to ask you about. If I am struggling with my sexual response, like either I'm having pain in intercourse or I feel like maybe I'm not producing the right hormones, who do I go see? Like, where would I start as far as getting medical attention for this type of struggle?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, doctors are very well trained in many, many diseases, but normal sexual function is not our strong point always. So you kind of have to seek out a doctor who has an interest or has advanced training in that. I would just start with your normal primary care physician or nurse practitioner and just start and just say, hey, you know, I'm having some concerns about my intimacy. And I've heard that sometimes hormones can be a part of that. Who do you recommend? And either they'll say, oh, I'm fine addressing that, or they'll hopefully have somebody to refer you to. Because when you do get into hormones and hormone supplementation, they usually are prescription products. So you have to have a prescribing person to help you with that. But as far as, you know, kind of simple pain, make sure you're using enough lubrication, make sure you're doing stuff that is pleasurable to you and you know all of that. Because hormones are, again, you're kind of getting specialized before you start with the basics. And it's always easy to start with the easy stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So definitely menopause changes a lot of things for women over time. Can you talk about how that changes desire and female sexual response for better or for worse?
Yeah. So let's define menopause first, because I think that's a good place to start for people. The average age of menopause for American women is 51, and it's unbelievable. But even by about age 35 to 40, you'll start to see hormones change. And I always apologize. I'm like, I'm not calling anybody old. It's just the data. Point being, years before age 51, it's possible that you start to notice hormone changes. And then the other thing about low estrogen status, so let's say menopause starts at 51 for you, and you say, hey, and my hot flashes are done now. Great, I must be over menopause. But menopause is by definition no menstrual period times 12 months. But the low estrogen stage keeps going, and it's a progressive condition or a progressive disease. It's the gift that keeps on giving. So certainly by the time you're 60, 65, 70, if you haven't addressed the health of the tissues down there, it's progressively could get worse and worse. So there's no better time to start than the now. But what happens when the estrogen starts going down, your progesterone starts to go down, and your testosterone starts to go down. And that's really where that reactive desire starts kicking in. If you're like, back when I was 18, like everybody was looking good. I was thinking about sex all the time. Why can't I be 18 again? And it's like, well, the things you do to have intimacy when you're 45 are probably different than what you had to do when you're 18. That's just normal part of getting older and having the hormone changes. women will see it at varying ages, but average age of menopause, again, 51.
Okay, so I have read many, many, many studies, and this is something that I feel like is my mission in life, is to change this, but I see studies all the time where they've interviewed women who say that they're having their best sexual experience after the age of 64. And I'm like, wait, what? Like, we should be enjoying the best sex of our whole lives. Like, why do I have to wait until I'm in my 60s to enjoy sex, right? So that's kind of my mission, is to change that. But can you explain why on earth women would have their best sex of their entire lives at age 64?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that awesome? First of all, it's nothing but awesome to be like, not only is it possible to have sex throughout the ages, but it is also possible it could get better and better. But so here's the thing, if you're younger than 65, what tips can we learn to have that good sex now, right?
Yes.
So why do they have the best sex of their lives? Because many times they don't care as much about what other people think. And, you know, that's just mind blowing. But there's actually good data to say, like, after menopause, women really do care less about what society thinks about them. And they care less about, do I look good? Is he going to be okay with me today? What does he care about this fat roll? Like, because all of those thoughts about what you think other people are thinking about you, that destroys sex lives. Oh. And so the older women, they've gotten really good at, I know my body, I know what turns me on, I'm completely comfortable with myself. They might be in a relationship where they're like, I'm completely trusting of this partner, where we communicate wonderfully. All those good things that you can have now to have a wonderful sex life, I think women, just with time and with wisdom, they figure it out more and more.
Yeah. Well, I am all for 60-year-olds having great sex, but I'm like, let's bring this down so that we can be having great sex all the time, right?
Totally.
I don't want to have to wait that long.
Yeah, you don't have to wait. Yeah, they're not taking any like magic potion. They've just really, I mean, focusing on getting out of your head, getting into your body, and realizing what turns you on and what gives you pleasure is just so huge. And I think the more wisdom and maturity you have, you know, the more mistakes you make, the more you learn, right?
Yeah. So they've made a few mistakes and they're like, it's fine. It's all fine. Yeah. That level of self-criticism and all that stuff is mostly gone, which is fantastic.
Yeah. And I think another thing, you know, again, what tips and tricks do they have is like, usually the kids are out of the house.
Yeah.
Usually maybe that, you know, if they're working, it isn't kind of that crazy work of your 30s and 40s that people are doing, or they're finding work that's really fulfilling to them, or they have great boundaries. So they're able to say, I'm leaving my thoughts about work at work. You know, right now sex is about sex, not what happens after sex. So yeah, there's so much wisdom. It's a beautiful thing.
You just gave me a fantastic idea. I think I would love to gather up a whole bunch of like really happily and fulfilled 65-year-old women and just ask them, like, how did this happen?
Totally.
All just glean from their wisdom.
Totally.
From a doctor's perspective, is there such a thing as a normal level of sexual desire, like dependent on your age? Meaning, is it normal to desire sex a certain number of times a week or something, depending on our age, or is everybody's different?
I love that question because it's so normalizing to know that there's no normal.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people think about sex like, okay, so I'm supposed to have 5 fruits and vegetables a day. I'm supposed to exercise for 30 minutes, 5 times a week. Oh, we're supposed to sleep for 8 hours a night. We're given all of these prescriptions of kind of what normal healthy is. And then we want to extrapolate that. And I think, you know, you'll read studies and they'll be like, oh, the average married couple in their 30s has sex 3 times a week. And then you'll be like, well, shoot, you know, because now you don't match up. Or maybe you're having sex 3 times a week, but it's not even enjoyable. So what's the point, right? Would you rather have sex 1 time a week and have immense pleasure from it, or 3 unsatisfying sexual activities a week? So I think, you know, taking those statistics and saying one rule does not apply to all. And certainly it is completely, I mean, just talking about what normal sexual, you know, function is, it's completely okay to just never, there are people who are just have never ever had a sex drive. They aren't interested. They're not distressed by it. They're perfectly fine with it. And there's nothing broken with them. That's just them. What's very interesting is to take that and then bring it into a relationship, right? Because people are like, oh, but my sex drive is different than my partner's sex drive. Totally normal. I like cheeseburgers and he likes sushi. You know, I love running and he likes riding his bike. We like different things. It's perfectly normal for us to have different sex drives, and that's okay. Now, what do you do and how do you communicate about those sex drives, because both people's needs should be met? But I think it's, again, so normalizing. It is not the low sex drive person's job to rise to the higher sex drive's level. It's not your job. That's not your duty. They can help take care of themselves. And I think that's just so relieving for women to be like, your sex drive is your sex drive. It's okay. It's not your job. My partner loves running marathons. It's not my job to start running marathons.
So good. Yeah. Oh my goodness. This has been amazing. I am so grateful that we have this conversation. And I honestly think it's going to help so many people. Like, I literally cannot wait to press publish on this. I'm going to ask you my signature question, which is, if you had the undivided attention of every woman in the entire world for just a few minutes, what is the most important thing you could teach them about female desire and sexual response?
You are not broken. Whoever you are is good enough.
I kind of knew you were going to say that.
You're like, just in case you were going to say something different. But yeah, I mean, society tells us things that then we believe it, right? And like, if only I blah, 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 then sex would be good. It's like, no. Love yourself. And that's, you know, it's easy to say, hard to do sometimes, but it's like, love yourself and realize that pleasure for you is pleasure for you. Don't do it for anybody else.
I love that. So good. So much wisdom here. All right. Tell my listeners where they can find you and listen to your You Are Not Broken podcast and all the good stuff that you have to offer.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. So iTunes, Spotify, wherever you guys listen to podcasts, I'm at You Are Not Broken. On Instagram, I'm Kelly Casperson, MD. And then my Facebook page is You Are Not Broken.
Awesome. We'll make sure to link to all that in the show notes. And I'm sure we'll have you back because this was so good. My guess is I'm going to publish this and I'm going to get so many comments about like more questions. So I will make sure that we know where to find you and can get more goodness from you. And thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I absolutely loved this episode. And even though I consider myself a sexpert and somebody who is well-versed in all things sexuality, I learned so much from Dr. Casperson, and I am so grateful for all of the training she's done in this area and for all that she has to contribute to this conversation. I urge you to go and listen to her podcast, You Are Not Broken, because she is always learning and adding to the conversation, and she just does it in the best way. If you have any questions about anything that we talked about in this episode or any episode of On the Brighter Side, I hope that you will schedule a 30-minute relationship breakthrough call with me. You can find that on my website at onthebrightersideofmarriage.com. You can also download my free cheat sheet with all of the resources that I suggest to spice up your sex life and make it more exciting. Because honestly, is there anything better than a thriving, healthy sex life? My goal is to lower the divorce rate by helping couples have better sex. So I hope you will join me for my interview with Kristen Jensen next week. And until then, have courage, be kind, and stay on the brighter side.